From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, Paul Brandis, White House Bureau Chief of West Wing Reports. On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. North Korea has launched another missile, fueling fresh tensions with the United States and other nations. And speaking of tensions, Russia and its ally Belarus have begun war games, also fueling tensions with the United States and its allies. And here in the United States, President Trump and congressional leaders discuss immigration, specifically the so-called DACA program. Let's begin with North Korea. Another missile fired over Japan. Linda, what are the North Koreans up to and what do they want?
Well, it would appear that this is a reaction to the sanctions. The hope was that additional sanctions approved in the UN would show the North Koreans that the rest of the world is serious about, containing them. But the North Koreans said, okay, watch this, and fired another missile over Japan. So I think this is, answered a lingering question, which is, will sanctions have any impact? And I think the result is that North Korea is going to do what it's going to do, and that the answer is likely deterrence.
What do you think, Tom?
Well, the North Koreans have shown time and again that they don't care about UN resolutions. They don't care about sanctions. The sanctions passed by the Security Council this time are tougher than the previous segment, but they still are not. They're not going to bring North Korea to its knees. I think the only reason that would really prompt North Korea to sit up and take notice and maybe think about changing its belligerent tone, maybe, would be a naval blockade of North Korea and personal sanctions against many more senior government officials, including Kim Jong-un. I don't think that's going to happen. The Russians and the Chinese think the North Koreans are out of control, but they don't want to just rubber stamp anything the Western members of the Security Council want to do. So I think it's just more back and forth, more saber rattling or missile rattling, I suppose. And I think the North Koreans have figured out that military option is probably not going to happen because the consequences would be too severe for everybody, North Korea and the West. And so they can just continue to flex their muscles.
Well, the Security Council recently passed these stringent, what are at least called the most stringent measures yet against North Korea, this limited ban on oil, which they badly need to run their economy, exports of textiles, which provides a huge amount of the revenue that they need. These things have just begun, so we don't know what effect they will have. What else can the UN do on top of that?
Well, they could, as I said, they could order a naval blockade. I don't think there's much more that they are prepared politically to do. And on the oil question of oil imports, there is a thriving black market run by the Russians, either more likely with the complicity of Moscow. But there are a lot of under-the-radar black market oil dealers just across the border from North Korea. And so North Korea has ways to get more oil, not as much as they would like, but so I don't think that has been particularly effective.
And they've also stockpiled oil. And so I think that if there was a blockade, the North Korean leadership would not suffer, but the people would suffer. And the government has shown that they're willing to allow their people to suffer.
They had a
big famine.
Mass famines,
right,
years ago. They don't seem to care what,
right,
happens to their people.
Exactly.
Also, Linda, President Trump, I think, has said that this kind of behavior will not be tolerated. He's hinted of using military force against Pyongyang. He says correctly that all options are on the table, yet his advisors still talk of nothing but diplomacy. Where do you think this is ultimately headed?
I think we're headed toward a policy of deterrence and containment. I mean, we've seen this in history. And in 1950, the Truman administration contemplated a preemptive strike to keep the Soviet Union from acquiring nuclear weapons. But they obviously didn't go there. In the 1960s, the Kennedy administration feared that that Mao Zedong was mentally unstable and that he should not have nuclear weapons either. But, we learned to live with a nuclear Soviet Union and now Russia and a nuclear China. So we'll have to learn to live with nuclear Korea, regardless of what Donald Trump says.
The real question is, I guess, is Kim Jong-un sane or insane? I mean, I think the United States' calculation, more or less, is that he may be crazy, but he's not insane. If you accept that premise, then you have to assume that he understands that the consequences of actually launching one of these missiles against a country, against Japan or against a piece of the United States like Guam, would have catastrophic military repercussions. And we all know that Seoul is only about 40 miles south of the demilitarized zone, and even a massive American strike would probably not be able to take out all the artillery. So I think the consequences of Kim striking first are so great that I believe, it doesn't matter what I believe, the U.S. government believes that he's not going to take a first step.
So crazy, but not insane. I'm not sure where the line is between those two. But
that's why it's so difficult to figure out exactly what to do.
Let's move on to another worrisome subject. That, of course, is Russia. Big war games have started in the past few days. Moscow calls this Operation Zapad. Zapad, of course, means West. Same question as before, and this time I'll start with you, Linda. And I know you've spent a lot of time, as I have, in Russia. Mm-hmm. You're an expert on that country. What are the Russians up to, specifically Vladimir Putin? What does he want?
What he's doing is showing off how the military has been transformed under his rule and how he was able to put together an effective force that he's deployed to Syria and to Ukraine in recent years. So these exercises happen every 4 years, and it's in the past has been so 4 years ago when it happened, the thinking is that they left equipment behind and then used that to grab Crimea. So, and of course, this sort of the meta view of this is that this exercise is potentially an effort in the future to grab the three Baltic nations, which are now independent again. So this is, the Baltic nations are terribly frightened by this, and the United States and NATO are watching closely.
We're talking about Estonia, Latvia, yes. Lithuania. Now, those countries were actually part of the Soviet Union, seized by Stalin, mm-hmm. just as World War II was getting underway. But traditionally, historically, as you say, they've always been independent. Does Putin really want them back, or he wants to just restore the empire? I mean, what is he trying to do?
I don't know that he really wants them back, but I think he definitely wants them kind of cowering in his shadow and not being aggressively in the West. I mean, they are members of NATO, so they are in the West. But, an attack on NATO, an attack on any of the three Baltic countries, an invasion, an annexation, some kind of really aggressive effort would just really, it would, of course, trigger Article 5 of NATO. It would be an act of war. It would really test the West and NATO. And I don't think Putin wants to go there at this point.
Tom, what do you think?
But Putin, as always, wants to flex his muscles, wants to have the world respect him. The pretext for this operation is, according to the Russians, is that they want to test their ability to mobilize large numbers of troops and equipment, aircraft, artillery, in situations where sort of trouble just pops up and they've got to move quickly to deal with a contingency situation. And that is the same rationale they use for similar exercises in Georgia and Ukraine in times past, which we all know both were invaded by Russians and Russian sympathizers. So that's what I think has NATO on edge. I think this is just more, look at how important we are, look what we can do, just to give the West pause. And also, Belarus, where these maneuvers are occurring, is kind of the last buffer the Russians have. They're just worried about Western encroachment, and I think NATO has no intention of trying to move its borders any further to rattle the cage of the Russians, but it's just a way for Putin to say, we're better than you think, I'm running a good show, don't push us too far because we can retaliate in force.
The Russians have always had this xenophobia towards the West, specifically with regards to America, haven't they?
Yes, indeed. And I just remember I went to the Ford-Brezhnev summit in Vladivostok in November of 74, and that's where I first heard a phrase that I have heard from the Russians, from the Soviets, and now the Russians for decades. We demand respect. We don't get enough respect. We demand respect. With a lot of table pounding. Remember Nikita Khrushchev taking off his shoe and pounding his shoe at the UN. This is a recurrent theme, and I think Putin is the latest manifestation of an inferiority complex that he is determined to fix and also to prop himself up domestically.
Mm. All right. We'll talk a bit more about Russia in just a minute. First, a reminder that you are listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Paul Brandis from West Wing Reports, and joining me today are Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor and Tom DeFrank. He is contributing editor for National Journal. This is also a reminder that you can listen to Issues Online as a podcast. The program is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it, and then please tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page. Just look for Current Affairs with Carol Castile. And now back to our panelists. Linda, we were talking about Russia and these war games. You know, the Russians were hopeful that the election of Donald Trump would usher in some kind of new relations between Washington and Moscow. Things were very tense between President Obama and President Putin. It hasn't quite turned out that way. What happened?
Well, we've had a series of expulsions. We've had tit for tat starting in December when President Obama, the outgoing president, kicked out some Russians over their Russian hacking and meddling in our election. And then the Russians waited, but eventually required us to let go hundreds of personnel from our diplomatic facilities throughout Russia, over 700, mostly Russian employees, actually. Then the Russians the Americans have then done another round of expulsions, closing facilities, et cetera. So things are really in a deep freeze. I'm actually going over there in a week for a citizens diplomatic effort. And we'll see. I mean, this is, we keep saying, is this a new Cold War? And I resist saying that, but it really does have that feel. I would also add that, you talk about Russian xenophobia, which is definitely there, but they also love the West in a way. I mean, the Russian crest shows the eagle looking both West and East. They really look in both directions. And that desire for respect, I think, is a sign of how they care what we think of them, what Americans think of them. And I get that whenever I'm in meetings with Russians, that the respect thing, that's the number one thing. We have to respect the sacrifices they made during World War II and just the greatness of Russia, their culture, and just, their abilities and their intelligence.
Well, we were allies in World War II, of course, and got along quite well, which leads to the next question, which is, and I think you just alluded to this, are Russia and America destined to always be adversaries? That has not always been the case.
No, we've been allies on more than one occasion, but I think there's always going to be that tension, that that sort of fascination with each other, but also that that kind of geopolitical tension over spheres of influence and greatness and our respect for them. I mean, Americans don't worry about what the Russians think of them as much as the other way around. They really have that a little bit of an inferiority complex, I think. But I think this has it's always been thus and will continue in the future.
And Tom, since you have such a long background between Washington and Moscow, you mentioned going to Vladivostok in the mid-1970s. Is the Cold War back?
I think so. Not in the sense that there's any prospect of a hot war, a missile exchange. I don't think anybody thinks that is going to happen. But Russia is trying to reinvigorate its standing around the world. It's going to push. It's xenophobic. It's paranoid. It worries about the West wanting to pick off some other countries to join NATO. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think in terms of kind of political dialogue, I think the Cold War is back in a slightly diminished situation. The other thing that we haven't mentioned is that the whole business about Russian interference in the election, in the 2016 election, has frozen the Trump administration's ability to reach out. It's pretty clear President Trump for a long time was trying to do better with the Russians, but I think he's been widely criticized for that. And
he's never even mentioned it, really.
No, because Congress has put him on notice by passing legislation that limited his ability to make overtures with the Russians without some approval by Congress. This is not a good situation, and I think Putin understands that the prospect of a détente with the Americans is not likely anytime soon.
Okay, there's a word from the 70s detente. It harkens of Nixon and Brezhnev. Well, here in Washington, a deal or no deal, I think perhaps, is the phrase. We've seen something rather extraordinary in the past week or so. A Republican president, an ostensibly Republican president, appearing to agree with the leaders of the opposition Democratic Party on the key issue of immigration, specifically with these so-called Dreamers. Tom, what's going on here?
Well, there is a political subtext here, and then I'll answer your question. President Trump does not like the congressional Republican leadership, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and House Speaker Paul Ryan. He has not forgiven them for not being able to pass a health care bill, reform bill, a repeal and replace of Obamacare. So he's furious with them. He doesn't like them. He thinks they're part of the problem, not part of the solution. So he is rather eagerly sticking it to both McConnell and Ryan by having Democratic leaders to the White House for dinner and for meetings. He had no use for either Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, or Nancy Pelosi, the former speaker who is now the House minority leader, but now he calls them Chuck and Nancy. And the bottom line is, I think President Trump is a creature of the polls. He sees almost 70% of the American people think that these 800,000 Dreamers, so-called Dreamers, meaning young Americans who were brought to this country illegally when they were 2, 3, 4, 6 years old, should not be thrown out, should not be deported because they arrived here illegally, but not through any fault of their own. And so I think Trump wants to protect them. He said he's, as we've talked about on this program before, he is cracking down on illegal immigration, but he's going to give Congress 6 months to come up with legislation to protect the Dreamers. And I think that's widely supported politically in this country, except for core constituencies of President Trump. The Republican right has gone really far to the right on immigration, have a real problem with this. And some of his more ardent Republican defenders have fallen out of bed with him, so to speak, on this. And so what you've seen in the last handful of days is massive damage control. The Republican right has revolted. President Trump's spokesperson said, well, they talked about an arrangement, but it wasn't a deal. Mm. And the Democrats have said, we have agreed on a framework, and we're going to keep talking. And then Trump has said the wall between the U.S. and Mexico, which was so central to his election thematics, that can come later. And now he's saying, well, we won't do this unless they agree to the wall. And so what it is it's more of the kind of the chaos that we have come to expect from the Trump administration. But the bottom line is there probably will be some sort of an arrangement between President Trump and the Democrats, which will then put pressure on the Republicans to go along or look like they're the villains in forcing out these more or less innocent young Americans.
Meantime, Linda, there was big news about this in another way. The U.S. Supreme Court, that, of course, is the highest court that we have in the United States, gave the president a partial victory, saying that his travel ban, big portions of it at least, are legal and can remain in place. What about that?
Well, the legality of the travel ban has been under legal challenge ever since it was announced, both the first version and the second version. So we're really dealing with the second version of the ban, which went from 7 countries to 6 countries, predominantly Muslim countries. The latest move in the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to exclude, I think it's 24,000 refugees from entering the country. So the larger context here is that the president of the United States and the executive branch have broad power, not absolute power, but broad power to decide who may enter the country. And, you know, people are upset about the travel ban. They think it's unfair to the people. You know, the vast majority of people who want to come here are, you know, they're coming for family reasons or they're coming to study. But, you know, there are some bad eggs in theory. And Trump has said he wants to just make sure our system of vetting is adequate. And the lower courts have sided with the opponents of this ban. But the Supreme Court keeps coming in and knocking things back toward the administration. Now, they haven't actually had a real ruling. They're not hearing their case on the travel ban until October 10th. So we don't really have the final determination. But when a court is considering an issue, there's always the question of, do you block its implementation before they get to reach the merits of the case? So that's where we are. And the high court continues to limit the ability of opponents to sort of overrule the administration before the court can rule. Now, the situation with this is that, you know, it was supposed to be a temporary ban, and that temporary ban is effectively almost over anyway. So the Supreme Court ruling, it could in some ways become moot. But I kind of hope they do hear the case. I want to know what the answer is. You know, was Donald Trump allowed to do this? We still don't know.
It's interesting that, and whoever wants to answer this one, it's interesting that a lot of these Republicans, Tom, you were talking about the president's base, they seem shocked that he would move in this leftward direction. But President Trump was a Democrat for a long portion of his life. He's given interviews in the past identifying with the Democrats, saying, well, I think in a lot of cases, the economy and so forth has done better under the Democrats. Is he a Democratic president in Republican clothing, Tom?
I don't think he's a Democratic president in Republican clothing, but I think he's an independent president in Republican clothing. I mean, there have been some published analyses which make the case that he's really perhaps the most independent American president since Abraham Lincoln in the 1860s. He's a deal maker. Desperate is too strong a word here. He really wants to have a deal, what he calls a win. I need a win. You can argue how effective he has been or not, but I think the singular accomplishment so far has been to put a conservative judge, Neil Gorsuch, onto the Supreme Court. But I think Mitch McConnell had perhaps more to do with that than President Trump. And so Trump is looking to show that he can put together coalitions that pass bills and get things accomplished. And again, he loathes the Republican leadership in Congress. They try to make nice, but it's becoming harder and harder for both sides to even pretend to be nice. As Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said the other day, well, you know, he can make a deal with the Democrats, but the Republicans have, you know, we have a say here, too.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Our thanks to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for National Journal. Thanks to both of you. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis, White House Bureau Chief for West Wing Reports. Thank you for listening.